Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 14th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing. This week it's an ocean scene. Rough seas, cloudy skies. Volodymyr Zelensky has a distraught look on his face, and he's floating on a piece of wood or something like that. In the background is a lifeboat. It's being piloted by French President Emmanuel Macron, and in the front of it, holding a life preserver, is British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. They're on the way to get Zelensky. The headline is Rescue Mission. Can Europe save Ukraine without U.S. support? And that is our first main story. We'll start with that. Trump halts military aid for Ukraine. What happened? President Trump this week suspended U.S. military assistance and intelligence sharing with Ukraine just days after a contentious Oval Office meeting in which he publicly berated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for failing to cooperate with his plan for a ceasefire with Russia. Ukraine had been expected to receive some $9 billion in U.S. weapons and equipment this year, including desperately needed artillery, ammunition, and air defense systems. Those shipments are now on hold, along with U.S.-supplied intelligence that helps Ukraine target Russian forces and that gives Kyiv advance warning of incoming Russian drone and missile strikes. Thousands of people will die because of the catastrophic decision, said Ukrainian lawmaker Oleksiy Goncharenko. CIA Director John Ratcliffe said the pause will go away if Zelensky shows he's willing to return to the negotiating table. Relations between Zelensky and the Trump administration collapsed last week after the Ukrainian leader noted at a White House press conference that Russian President Vladimir Putin had violated previous ceasefires. Putin would likely violate a new agreement, Zelensky said, without U.S. security guarantees for Kyiv, something Trump has refused to provide. I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media, Vice President J.D. Vance replied. Trump then tore into Zelensky on camera, saying he was gambling with World War III. White House officials expelled the Ukrainian delegation, and an agreement that would have given the U.S. access to Ukraine's mineral wealth was left unsigned. Zelensky later called the Oval Office clash regrettable. In a bid to heal U.S.-Ukraine ties, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and French President Emmanuel Macron scrambled to put together a more favorable ceasefire plan, with Macron proposing a one-month limited truce and plans for European peacekeepers to be deployed to Ukraine. Vance dismissed the plan, saying the U.S. minerals deal was a way better security guarantee than 20,000 troops from some random country that hasn't fought a war in 30 or 40 years. In a joint address to Congress, Trump said he'd received a letter from Zelensky agreeing to talks and declared that Russia was ready for peace. Wouldn't that be beautiful? What the editorial said. Putin must have delighted in the Oval Office brawl, said the Wall Street Journal. Trump and Vance dressed down Zelensky as if he were a child late for dinner, with Vance claiming the Ukrainian leader had shown insufficient gratitude for U.S. aid, though he has thanked America countless times. They had not a word of criticism for the dictator who invaded Ukraine in 2022. Trump may not like dealing with a war that didn't start on his watch, but he doesn't want to be remembered as the president who surrendered Ukraine to Putin, with all the damage to U.S. interests that would result. One positive thing Trump did achieve with his tantrum is to put the rest of the West on high alert, said the Boston Globe. Zelensky received a hero's welcome in London this week, where Starmer announced a new $2.7 billion loan for Ukraine and joined other European leaders in pledging a coalition of the willing to supply weaponry and potentially peacemaking troops. But their promises remain vague, and any peace deal would require at least the grudging participation of the U.S. What the columnist said, Zelensky made a big mistake in the White House, said Eli Lake in the Free Press, when Vance falsely claimed that the Biden administration had never tried diplomacy with Putin. The Ukrainian leader should have chosen to nod politely and let it go, in the interest of seeing the minerals deal completed. Instead, he brought up Putin's past broken promises, including a 2019 ceasefire signed during Trump's first term. But Zelensky's poor diplomatic tactics don't negate his wider point, that any deal that doesn't guarantee Ukraine's security from future Russian attacks is functionally meaningless. The U.S. is now a de facto Putin ally, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Don't take my word for it. Russian state media is celebrating Zelensky's verbal battering in the White House, and Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says Trump's agenda largely aligns with our vision. Trump has explicitly said he trusts Putin more than Zelensky, and for all his calls to halt the killing, he has demanded no concessions from Russia. Trump's spineless defenders in the GOP are falling in line, said Mona Shirin in the Bulwark. In 2022, Senator Lindsey Graham vowed to stand with and for Ukraine's freedom until every Russian soldier is expelled. But last week, he claimed he was never more proud of Trump and called Zelensky's behavior disrespectful. House Speaker Mike Johnson demanded Zelensky return to the negotiating table in gratitude or resign. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio has transformed himself from a hawk into a toady for a man determined to destroy the Western alliance. If the U.S. keeps aid on pause, can Europe fill the gap? Asked The Economist. The European Union has announced plans to boost defense spending by $845 billion, and Ukraine is also rapidly expanding its own defense industry. Still, the U.S. has been providing a large chunk of Ukraine's military aid until this week, and the logistics of replacing it require time that Ukraine does not have. And so the war's horror continues, said Nick Patton Walsh in CNN.com, with Russia targeting civilians and Kyiv struggling to take out Moscow's missiles and drones. There are no good choices ahead for Ukraine, no sure bets, except widespread opposition to surrender. Dignity is also a value, one Kyiv resident told me. If Russia cannot destroy it, why does the U.S. think it can? Controversy of the week. Budget. Will the GOP cut entitlements? House Republicans want to gut Medicaid, said Michael Kinnikin in the New York Times. By a two-vote margin with no Democratic support, the GOP majority last week passed a budget resolution for fiscal year 2025. And despite President Trump's repeated promises not to touch entitlements, that plan seeks to partially offset the $4.5 trillion cost of extending Trump's 2017 tax cuts by hacking up to $880 billion from Medicaid, the medical assistance program that covers 79 million Americans, including half of all U.S. children. The resolution is just a statement of principles and will have to survive the Senate and more House votes. Some GOP senators from states that expanded Medicaid under the 2010 Affordable Care Act have vowed to protect the program. Anything that slashes into benefits for people who are working, I'm not going to be for, said Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. Let's hope the Senate kills this cruel plan, said the San Antonio Express News in an editorial. The cuts would devastate rural hospitals that rely on Medicaid, and for many poor Americans, could be the difference between life and death. Every GOP budget makes liberals shriek about draconian spending cuts, said National Review. But this latest plan is modest, really too modest, if the goal is to tackle America's debt crisis. All told, the resolution shaves a mere $2 trillion off the $86 trillion the federal government is set to spend over the next decade, and would add nearly $3 trillion to the deficit over that period. As for Medicaid cuts, said Eric Bohm in Reason, the resolution tasked the House committee that oversees the program with saving $880 billion overall. There are plenty of ways to find that cash without throwing needy Americans off Medicaid. With the government borrowing ever more money to cover interest payments on the national debt, it would be fiscally foolish to balk at asking states to shoulder more of Medicaid's costs, say, or imposing work requirements on able-bodied recipients. Then why are Republicans secretly freaking out? Asked Ellie Quinlan Hutengling in the New Republic. Last week's vote was an impressive show of unity for House Speaker Mike Johnson's fractious majority, and a win for President Trump, who worked the phones to keep skittish lawmakers in line. But with the resolution in the rear view, many are privately fretting that their vote could bite them in the midterms. Historically, things don't go well for parties who tinker with Americans' health care, said Mary Ellen Klass in Bloomberg. With Medicaid recipients disproportionately clustered in states that voted for Trump, about 20% of Missouri residents are on the program, and 32% in Louisiana, even discussions of cuts represent a huge political gamble for Republicans. That's why Trump is the perfect president to reform entitlements, said Dace Potas in USA Today. Ineligible to run in 2028, he has no personal fear of a voter backlash, while the last month has shown that he has the stomach for risky spending cuts. Yes, slashing Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security would hurt Republicans for a cycle or two, but isn't that a price worth paying for meaningful and lasting spending reform? That's probably the plan, said James Downey in MSNBC.com. For anyone who thought Trump might be constrained by his promises to not touch entitlements, last week's Medicaid pirouette should be a wake-up call. In his zeal for enriching the rich and further immiserating the poor, this president is not unduly concerned with keeping a story straight. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for laying low after GOP leaders told congressional Republicans to stop holding in-person town halls. House Speaker Mike Johnson claimed without evidence that the people who have recently filled town halls across the country and angrily spoken out against cuts to government are professional protesters, so it's wise not to play into that. It was a good week for vowels after Scottish investment company ABRDN announced that it is reverting to a variant of its original name. Aberdeen, after enduring several years of public mockery, CEO Jason Windsor called it a pragmatic decision, making a new phase for the organization. And it was a good week for mice in crisis, after researchers found that rodents will try to resuscitate unconscious peers with grooming, biting, and tongue pulling. These behaviors are reminiscent of how humans are taught to clear the airway of an unconscious individual during CPR, the scientists noted. But it was a bad week for the youth, with the rise of a new TikTok craze that involves users recording their own agonized reactions as they drop heavy objects, including vacuum cleaners, air fryers, and wooden tables, on their feet. Podiatrist Benjamin Bullen cautioned that participants may be setting themselves up for a lifetime of pain and disability. It was a bad week for co-pilots after Arizona moved to ban motorists from driving with pets on their laps. The ban was approved by the state's legislature's Public Safety Committee over the lone objection of Senator Dan Gowen, who argued, "Animals will just do what they do in a vehicle sometimes." Finally, it was a bad week for working the refs after an 8th Division German soccer match was postponed because the young son of a player bit the referee's left testicle during pre-match warm-ups. "I did not start the game because of the pain I was in and the situation," explained referee Stefan Koller. And here's a short and other news piece. Judges block Trump from firing independent watchdogs. Two federal judges this week ruled against President Trump's attempt to remove officials at independent agencies, setting up a likely Supreme Court fight. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson blocked Trump's ousting of Hampton Dellinger, head of the Office of Special Counsel, an independent watchdog that investigates whistleblower reports from federal workers. The Trump administration argued the president had the power to fire Dellinger without cause, but Jackson disagreed, citing a 1978 statute. In a second case, U.S. District Judge Rudolph Contreras ruled this week that Trump couldn't remove Kathy Harris, head of the Merit Systems Protection Board, a group that reviews federal firings. The bids to remove Dellinger and Harris foreshadow a potential battle over other agencies, including the Federal Election Commission, whose chairwoman is also fighting Trump's move to oust her. The briefing this week is titled, "When the Insurer Says No." Health insurance companies appear to be denying a growing share of patient claims. Why? How often do insurers deny coverage? Health insurance firms process some 5 billion claims each year for reimbursement or for pre-authorization of treatment, of which about $850 million are denied. While data from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners shows that denial rates have remained static for 5 years, other evidence suggests they're rising fast. In Maryland, regulators report claim denials are up 40% since 2019. And in a nationwide survey last year of doctors and other healthcare providers, 73% said denials are becoming more common. Denials for payment and treatment can be devastating for a patient's finances and health. Miranda Yaver, a health policy expert at the University of Pittsburgh, interviewed a patient with immunodeficiency who was denied medication because her multiple infections were bad, but not yet life-threatening in view of the insurer. "It was a mind-boggling assessment," said Yaver. "Anger at this process has become so widespread that after UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson was shot dead last year, social media was flooded with users praising the killer and telling their own denial stories. The fact that we pay into the system and then when we need it, we can't access the care we need makes no sense," said Robin Ginkle, a special ed teacher in Minnesota who had a claim for back surgery denied 3 times. "It feels like insurance companies do this on purpose in hopes you're going to give up." How do companies assess claims? They're typically reviewed by insurer-employed nurses. Sometimes the nurses are in the U.S., sometimes overseas, to make sure claims are medically necessary and don't involve unproven procedures. In some states, a doctor must sign off on a denial. Insurance firms say this process ensures that care is appropriate, efficient, and cost-effective. But critics argue the process is more about reducing cost for insurers than providing quality care. Dr. Debbie Day, a former claims reviewer at Cigna, said that in 2021 she was told by her bosses to work faster or risk being fired. Day said she wasn't meeting the company's productivity standards, which allow for a few minutes per claim, because she was spending time fixing error-filled denials from nurses in the Philippines. In one case, a nurse recommended denying treatment for a neck ultrasound because the treatment wasn't medically necessary. They noticed the nurse had gotten the body part wrong. Deny, deny, deny. That's how you hit your numbers, Day, who retired from Cigna in 2022, told ProPublica. Cigna called Day a disgruntled former employee and said its doctors did not rubber stamp nurses' denial recommendations. Do many patients appeal denials? Because so many people are daunted by the complexity of the process, which often requires making long phone calls and collecting evidence from medical studies, fewer than 1% of denied claims are appealed. It's hard to fight a big insurance company, said Larry Levitt of health research nonprofit KFF. To even begin, you need to understand the gobbledygook in the paperwork. Many patients end up paying for the care out of their own pocket or simply foregoing treatment. Yet, of those claims that are appealed, up to 3/4 are approved. Doctors told Missouri resident Edward Stratton, 65, in 2023 that he needed a transplant after cancer treatments destroyed his liver. His insurer, Elevance Health, denied the claim, saying a new liver doesn't improve outcomes for colorectal cancer patients, even though Stratton no longer had cancer. He appealed again in 2024, copying regulators, Elevance board members, and journalists on his email, and stating that another denial would lead to his death. Elevance overturned the denial. This appeal saved my life, said Stratton. How do insurers justify denial rates? They blame doctors and other providers for submitting often incomplete or inaccurate paperwork and for recommending expensive or unnecessary treatments and procedures. A 2018 study of claims from 1.3 million patients in Washington state found that in a single year, more than 600,000 patients underwent a treatment they didn't need at a collective cost of $282 million. Insurance companies also dismiss the argument that they make money by nixing claims, noting the industry's relatively small profits. In 2021, the sector had a 4% net profit margin, compared with nonprofit hospitals' nearly 11% margin and for-profit hospitals' 12%. I'm glad people are voicing their anger against insurers, said Rice University economist Vivian Ho, but they should be directing equal anger against hospitals, particularly since so many are nonprofit. Are lawmakers trying to reform the process? 10 states passed legislation last year aiming to limit pre-authorization requests, improve data about their usage, or shorten delays in processing. New Jersey now mandates that insurers decide requests within 3 days or 24 hours if marked urgent. The 2010 Affordable Care Act also authorized state-level consumer assistance programs to help residents appeal denials, but no funding has been allocated for them in recent years. Still, many states have set up offices without federal grants. Maryland's program helped consumers file 11,466 appeals in 2023, half of which were successful. A similar state program launched in Pennsylvania last year has so far succeeded in overturning and reinstating coverage in about 50% of cases. But across the U.S., many patients are on their own or don't know whom to turn to when a claim is denied. It's exhausting, said Ginkle, the Minnesota teacher, who recently switched insurance companies in a bid to get her back surgery approved. I can't keep going like this. Some of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Will Roberts Court save democracy? The fate of American liberal democracy rests with the U.S. Supreme Court, said Corbin K. Barthold. As President Trump tears the Constitution and rule of law to shreds, he's headed for a confrontation with the court's three swing justices, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. They are all traditional conservatives who may feel uneasy with Trump's dramatic expansion of presidential power. Trump is claiming authority to purge the federal government and civil service of anyone who fails his MAGA loyalty test. He seeks to withhold funds authorized by Congress and issued an executive order nullifying the 14th Amendment's declaration that all persons born on U.S. soil are citizens. He's announced that he who saves his country does not violate any law, a bone-chilling declaration of imperial intent. The supine Republican-controlled Congress will not serve as a check on Trump or impeach him. Now only the court can stop the monster they helped to create when they declared last year his official acts were immune to criminal prosecution. As the conservative Justice Antonin Scalia famously once wrote, "The wolf comes as a wolf." The looming Cuomo resurrection. Andrew Cuomo's potential comeback is a sign of the weird amnesia some Americans seem to have developed, said David A. Graham. The former New York Democratic governor was forced to resign in 2021 after a state investigation found that he'd sexually harassed at least 11 credible women accusers. He was also found to have strenuously covered up the number of COVID deaths in the state's nursing homes after he'd ordered infected patients to be discharged there from hospitals, and pocketed $5 million for a book his taxpayer-paid staff helped produce. Yet now he's running for New York City mayor, and with incumbent Eric Adams badly wounded by his own ethics scandal, Cuomo has quickly taken a wide lead in the polls. Like President Trump, Cuomo is benefiting from a broad backlash against cancel culture and wokeness. Indeed, while admitting to unwanted flirtation, he's portrayed himself as a victim. But it's absurd to believe that a sex pest and proven liar is the man to clean things up in New York. Still, most Democratic leaders are either acquiescing to Cuomo's return or openly supporting him. His resurrection represents a failure of the Democratic Party. This is one of the international columns, a How They See Us column. No longer the champion of democracies. America's leadership has switched sides in the war, said the Kyiv Independent in an editorial. The warning signs were there for weeks with President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance echoing propaganda straight from the mouth of Vladimir Putin, claiming that Ukraine was to blame for Russia's 2022 invasion. Last week, the two unleashed explicit hostility toward Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office, where he had been expected to sign an agreement that would give the U.S. a cut of our mineral wealth. The meeting devolved into an on-camera shout fest after Zelensky pointed out that unless Ukraine received security guarantees from the U.S., Putin would likely break a ceasefire agreement. Trump and Vance berated Zelensky for supposed ingratitude, called off the mineral deal, and sent him away without lunch. Let this sink in. The Ukrainian president, a U.S. ally, not some autocrat or enemy, became the first foreign leader ever to be kicked out of the White House. Trump expected Zelensky to grovel and kiss the ring, but don't think he'll treat Putin with such scorn. If there's any ring kissing when Trump meets Putin, the ring will be Russian. Ever since this conflict, we Russians have dreamed of seeing Zelensky put in his place, said Gevorg Mirzayan. We've watched him travel from Western capital to Western capital in his dirty sweater and his air of "you owe me everything." And now Trump and Vance have done it, humiliating him on camera, telling him that without America, he's a nobody. Some have wondered whether Zelensky picked a fight on purpose so he could inspire an anti-Trump alliance in Europe. After all, the Europeans all instantly rallied to his side. But it seems clear the altercation was orchestrated by the Americans. They knew that Zelensky was an unrestrained idiot who considered himself a fighter against evil, yet they practically fawned over Putin in his presence. Now that the rift has become clear and can be blamed on Zelensky, Trump can agree to Putin's terms on the Ukrainian issue without the risk of a negative reaction from much of the American electorate. This is the end of an era, said Andre Rizzi in El País from Spain. The alignment with Russia is a brutal confirmation of an abrupt U.S. turnaround as Washington abandons the role it has played for 80 years as defender of European democracy and leader of the free world. Trump's U.S. is a capricious imperialist power that demands submission, obeisance, and tribute. It is willing to cause Europeans lethal damage for an entente with other imperialist powers. As Ukraine is discarded like a pawn in a chess game, many in Asia worry that Taiwan could also be tossed aside, said the Taiwan Times in an editorial. The difference is that Trump is allying with Russia to contain China, which should mean Taiwan is too strategically important to be sacrificed. President Lai Ching-te certainly thinks so. He said, "We are chess players, not chess pieces." But then, a week ago, you could have said that about Europe. And the last word, our feature article. A rescue pilot's final flight. The tale of Pluto, the dog who survived a plane crash, was a new sensation, said Andrew Kay in the New York Times. This is the story of the volunteer pilot who died ferrying him to a new home. Suk Kim was loitering cheerfully on the tarmac of Culpeper Regional Airport in Northern Virginia one afternoon last November. He had a lot to be cheerful about. Just a few years earlier, Kim, a gregarious father of three, was anxiously leaving a stable career to pursue a childhood dream of flying. Now, at 49, he had a pilot's license, his own single-engine plane, and, as he proudly told his friends, a job lined up with a charter airline. On this day, though, he was indulging in a passion project, volunteering as a transport pilot for shelter animals, joining a small fleet of planes that would help relocate 23 dogs and 12 cats to rescue organizations around the Northeast. Among the dogs taking flight that afternoon was a one-year-old Yorkshire Terrier mix named Pluto, who had been discovered astray 6 weeks earlier along a highway in rural Georgia. Now Pluto found himself on a 1,000-mile odyssey that would carry him, in a quirky bit of fate, from an animal shelter just outside Albany, Georgia, to an organization just outside Albany, New York. Kim, petting and cooing at the animals on the tarmac, would be his chaperone for the final leg of the trip. After a 20-minute layover and a few minor comforts, sips of water from a bowl, nibbles of freeze-dried liver, a couple of affectionate scratches behind the ear, Pluto and three other dogs were shepherded into Kim's plane, a Mooney M20J. They nestled into crates that were padded with blankets and secured inside the cramped cabin with bungee cords. When Kim started the engine, its sudden roar caused a Pomeranian near the runway to jump out of a volunteer's arms, sending several humans scrambling after him. Glancing out the window, Kim smiled at the commotion. Then he took off. It was not a long trip. He had told his wife he would be home for dinner. but the pilot and the dogs in his custody would encounter storm clouds on the flight, and not all of them would reach their destination. It was a restless spirit that led the pilot to the skies. Born in Seoul, Kim spent his early childhood romping through the buzzing market where his mother owned a traditional Korean clothing store, eating spicy rice cakes from street vendors, and riding on the back of his father's motorcycle. He never quite lost that yearning for speed. When he was 9, his family moved to Burke, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, where early bouts of culture shock and struggles with ESL classes quickly gave way to a wholesale embrace of his new American life. He bent the pronunciation of his first name from Se-wook to Sook to accommodate the American tongue. He and his older brother, Se-jin, excelled in school and competed on local motocross circuit as teenagers. After college, he started a career in finance, beginning with a stint on Wall Street. After a few years, he moved back to Virginia, married, and had 3 children, Leah, Isaac, and Mason. Even after settling down, Kim hopscotched among hobbies and interests. He felt lucky that his wife, Anna, encouraged his capricious pursuits. "Did you know it was a childhood dream of mine to fly?" Kim asked Anna, seemingly out of the blue in 2019. "Why aren't you on it already?" she replied. With his wife's blessing, Kim spent almost a year away from home in Richmond to complete a flight training program. After that, he began compiling the 1,500 hours of flight time required by federal regulators to become a certified commercial pilot. That was when he heard about Pilots in Paws, an organization that connects volunteer pilots to animal shelters that need transport assistance. Soon he was completing missions, as the pilots call them, every week. Even after he reached 1,500 hours, the point at which many volunteer pilots seemed to lose interest, he kept going. "I want to save one more," Kim said often to his wife. When Pluto was picked up on October 16th along Route 82 in southern Georgia, he became one of the estimated 5.8 million animals in the United States that entered the shelter system in 2024, according to the national database Shelters Animal Count. "The dog lacked identification when he arrived," said Leah Orr, the director of the shelter, Best Friends Humane Society in Poland, Georgia. In such cases, her staff cycles through letters of the alphabet to assign names. "That day it was P. Pluto was an all-around happy dog," Orr said, "and yet he now risks joining the more than 600,000 animals that would be euthanized that year after failing to be adopted." Those in the animal welfare community describe an endlessly regenerating crisis, concentrated in areas of the South where, they say, numerous factors, shortages in veterinary care, different norms around pet ownership, the warmer climate, contribute to an epidemic of overflowing shelters and needless death. Among the only lifelines for these animals, then, is to be relocated to a place with more resources and more potential for adoption. That strategy has worked for Orr's shelter. Before she took over, roughly half of its animals were being euthanized, she said. Today, hardly any meet that fate, thanks in part to an aggressive strategy of transporting animals to the north. Pluto's journey, then, was fairly typical. First, a rescue organization signaled that it could take him and 2 other dogs from the shelter. Then a separate group of volunteers sprang into action to oversee their safe passage. Ground transport for these purposes can be grueling and inefficient. Some years ago, loosely organized networks of volunteer pilots began emerging with the aim of accelerating the process. And so, on November 24th, Orr put Pluto and 2 other dogs, a pair of puppies named Whiskey and Lisa, into a van and shuttled them to Southwest Georgia Regional Airport. There, they boarded a twin-engine Cessna 414, which would take them and more than 24 other dogs and cats as far as Virginia, where the animals would then be put on other planes to their final destinations. Onto Pluto's crate, volunteers stuck a slip of tape with 3 letters, NY, with the letters NY scribbled on it. Around midday on November 24th, Kim said goodbye to his family and left for the airport. Anna and the children were headed to her parents' house for lunch, a seafood boil, where Kim had hoped to join them. He risked being late for his flight, so he went ahead without eating. "Bring home leftovers," he said to his wife, "and I'll have them for dinner." Wearing a gray tracksuit, a baseball cap, and sunglasses, Kim drove to Manassas Regional Airport, where he kept his plane, and flew 14 minutes to Culpeper, where the rescue volunteers were assembling. By 3:31, he was airborne with the dogs, first taking an arced path to Harford County Airport in Churchville, Maryland, to drop off a fourth dog, Money, whose rescue had been separately arranged. After 22 minutes on the ground there, he set off again at 4:43 toward Albany. Anna, anticipating a late dinner with him that night, lay down for a late afternoon nap. She snapped to attention, though, at 6:10 p.m., when her phone vibrated with an unusual text message from her husband's number. It was an automated SOS alert, noting that she had been listed as a contact in event of an emergency. Confused, she carried her phone over to her daughter. "Mom," Leah Kim, 16, said to her mother, "this is real." Over the next quarter hour, the half dozen or so people following Kim's progress were simultaneously staggering to the same realization. His plane had disappeared from their flight trackers. He was not answering text messages. His arrival time at Albany International Airport had come and gone. Everyone was texting everyone else. Maybe he had gotten lost, or perhaps he had diverted somewhere for a cheap tank of fuel, as he was known to do. But as the minutes ticked away, the list of possible outcomes grew chillingly small. Back at home, Anna kept calling her husband's phone, which kept ringing. She imagined him immobilized somewhere, alive but unable to answer it. She kept wondering if she might hear his voice. Local authorities by then were learning that Kim's plane had made an unplanned descent into a remote area of the Catskill Mountains, and a team of police officers, firefighters, and forest rangers was mobilizing toward the ridge where his phone had last pinged. It took until 9:30 p.m. for the first team of rescuers to reach the general search area. It was not until 11:38 p.m. that they located the wreckage of the plane. It had come apart after piercing a stand of trees at 140 miles per hour. 2 hours later, they found Kim's body. The rescue team members remained on the scene through the night. They were aware that Kim had been chaperoning three dogs. Lisa, one of the puppies, was found dead in the wreckage. But then, to rescuers' amazement, they discovered Whiskey, the other puppy, burrowed into the snow. His legs were injured and he was clearly shaken up, but somehow alive. Finally, at 1:30 p.m., the following afternoon, more than 18 hours after the crash, the rescue workers glimpsed some movement on the ridge above them. One of the firefighters whistled and waved. A little brown dog scurried down to meet them. It was Pluto. He was, astoundingly, unharmed. Anna had gotten a call from the sheriff's office in Greene County, New York, at 2:30 a.m., confirming her worst fears. When she got to her mother-in-law's home the day after the crash, she found herself unable to speak. She sat and cried as someone else delivered the news. Sook Kim's extended family assembled there that day and returned for several days thereafter to cry together, to eat together, to simply be together. He had died 4 days before Thanksgiving, and some of them assumed that their annual gathering, hosted always by Kim's mother, Jiho, would not take place. But Anna insisted that it go on. As Kim's family navigated this period of turmoil in Virginia, Pluto was for the first time finding a measure of peace in New York. The story of the dogs who defied death was reported widely in the news media. Forsaken only weeks earlier, Pluto was suddenly famous, with people clamoring to take him in. Within days, more than 100 families from around the country had inquired about adopting him. Whiskey received veterinary treatment and remained in foster care while recovering from his injuries. Pluto was placed with Stephen and Rachel Clemens, a couple from Averill Park, New York, whose home stands in a family compound spread over 100 wooded acres. They renamed him Jack in honor of a family member who died the same day they brought him home. He survived a plane crash, so he was destined for a good life, Rachel said. He needed a good home, and we knew we could provide that. But some involved in the dog's harrowing journey found themselves somewhat troubled by its implications, seeing it as emblematic of so much of what was wrong with the current state of animal welfare. Several of the families who reached out about adopting him, for instance, lived in Georgia. It's ironic for someone to reach out to New York to adopt a dog they could have adopted a few weeks ago in their backyard, said Maggie Jackman Pryor, director of the animal shelter of Schoharie Valley, which coordinated Pluto's adoption. Carol Fry, who briefly fostered Pluto in the aftermath of the accident, was even more blunt. Why not go to your local shelter? Chances are there is one just like this one. Someone had to die? A human had to die for all these people who want this dog. It's kind of messed up. On December 5th, Suk Kim was laid to rest at a cemetery in Fairfax, Virginia, steps from his father's grave. He was buried in one of his beloved T-shirts with the phrase, "Can I pet your dog?" splashed across the chest, and a New York Mets baseball cap. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll do one of the obituaries today. The prolific actor who brought intensity to diverse roles, Gene Hackman, 1930-2025. Gene Hackman wasn't easily pigeonholed. A former Marine with a face he likened to that of your everyday mine worker, he drew accolades for his portrayals of tough characters with a menacing edge. These included the racist bullying detective Popeye Doyle in The French Connection, 1971, and the sadistic small-town sheriff in Unforgiven, 1992. But over more than 80 movie roles, he delved into a wide range of personalities. In The Conversation, 1974, he was a painfully shy surveillance expert. And in Hoosiers, 1986, a scrappy coach who inspires a team of underdogs. He showed comic flair as a sleazy Hollywood producer in Get Shorty, 1995, and an eccentric patriarch in The Royal Tenenbaums, 2001. Ever-present was Hackman's intensity and embrace of complexity. He could render the humanity in a hateful character or evoke a hero's flaws. Whether a character was sympathetic or not, that's not important to me, he said. I want to make you believe this could be a human being. Eugene Allen Hackman grew up in a fractious household in Danville, Illinois, said the Associated Press. His parents fought repeatedly, and his father, a newspaper pressman, frequently beat him. He found refuge in movie houses, taking Screen Rebels Errol Flynn and James Cagney as his role models. When he was 13, his father left, simply waving as he drove off. 3 years later, Hackman lied about his age to join the Marines. On tours in China and Japan, his brawling and resistance to authority led to 3 demotions, though working as a DJ on Armed Forces Radio whetted his taste for show business. After his discharge, he moved to New York and got married, said The Guardian. With his wife's encouragement, he decided to try acting, studying at the Pasadena Playhouse in California. Returning to New York, he hustled for stage and TV roles, supporting himself with work as a doorman and truck driver. His big chance came after he landed a small part in the 1964 movie Lilith and impressed the star Warren Beatty. When Beatty produced the 1967 classic Bonnie and Clyde, he cast Hackman as Clyde's livewire brother Buck. The film was a hit, and Hackman's assertive performance earned him a nomination for Best Supporting Actor. Hackman drew a second supporting actor nomination as a sensitive widower in I Never Sang for My Father, 1970. But it was the combustible Popeye Doyle who'd prove his breakout role, said the New York Times. He was the sixth actor offered the part, struggling to connect with the violent character. He offered to drop out. Yet his riveting portrayal helped make the gritty film a smash, and he won the Oscar for Best Actor. Soon, Hackman was making movies at such a pace that he became known as the hardest working actor in Hollywood, with roles including Lex Luthor in Superman, 1978, and a hard-nosed Navy captain in Crimson Tide, 1995. Plenty of his movies were duds, said the Washington Post, but with Hackman's restless, undirected energy, he made indelible impressions even in subpar films. Known for a peremptory attitude on set, he was nicknamed Vesuvius for his volcanic anger, and he clashed with many of his directors. Nor did he socialize with them. He shunned the party circuit and was quick to deflect any questions that demanded personal introspection. He did embrace the wealth that came with movie stardom, though, blowing a fortune on homes, private planes, and bad investments, a major reason why he was constantly working. Later roles were heavy on military men, villainous government officials, and lawyers, said CNN.com. Then he quietly retired at 74 after the weak 2004 comedy Welcome to Mooseport, telling Larry King, "It's probably all over." He moved with his second wife to Santa Fe, where he painted, sculpted, and wrote, turning out historical novels, a Western and a thriller. Often asked to return to film, he seemed content to let his body of work stand. "I was lucky to find a few things that I could do well as an actor," he said in 2011, "and that I could look at and say, yeah, that's all right." On the health and science page, we have Pharaoh's tomb discovered. Archaeologists have unearthed a Pharaoh's tomb near Egypt's Valley of the Kings, the first time a royal burial chamber has been excavated in that region since Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered in 1922. They initially thought the tomb belonged to a royal consort because it was located near the burial places of royal wives, but after an extensive evacuation, they now believe it's the resting place of Thutmose II, who reigned around 1480 BC, and whose wife, Hathisput, succeeded him as pharaoh. The evacuation suggests that she built tombs for her father and for Thutmose, who was her half-brother as well as her husband, and later moved them to a second tomb after the first one flooded. British archaeologist Piers Litherland said it took months for the Egyptologists to clear a way in, but they were richly rewarded. Part of the ceiling was still intact, a blue-painted ceiling with yellow stars on it. And blue-painted ceilings with yellow stars are only found in king's tombs, he told the BBC World Service. When you come across something that you're not expecting to find, it's emotionally, extremely, sort of turbulent. And some short notes on the Talking Points page. In the war in Ukraine, drones now kill more soldiers and destroy more armored vehicles than all traditional weapons of war combined. About 70% of all Russian and Ukrainian casualties are caused by drone strikes, according to Ukrainian officials. The Pentagon has ordered that all transgender service members be removed from the military. New Pentagon figures show there are currently 4,240 service members with a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, about 0.2% of the 2 million people in uniform. Previous estimates had put the number of transgender troops at about 15,000. May Musk, Elon Musk's mother, has made numerous trips over the past 6 months to countries that hope to influence Trump administration policies. A model and public speaker, May 76, visited China at least four times in late 2024 to endorse or model for seven brands. Her visits were promoted by state media. In January, she gave a talk at a government conference in Dubai titled, How I Raised Three Amazing Children, Including the Richest Man in the World. On the poll watch, more than 70% of Americans want to increase federal spending for elder care, veterans, cybersecurity, health care, disaster relief, and mental health care. 63% want increases in food assistance, 62% for disability assistance, and 59% for child care. The only category a majority of Republicans want to see cut is foreign aid. And we'll finish today's show with a tidy little quote from Robert Frost, quoted in the Gunnison Times. He says, "Poetry is the clear expression of mixed emotions." I have to think about that one. With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.